I'll call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. We have minutes from last Friday, March 18th meeting, and Representative Nelson will move the minutes from March 18th, 2005. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. The minutes from March 18th are adopted. All right, we're going to change the order around a little bit and start with Representative Holberg's bill today, House File 1810. And the chairman will move House File 1810 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And Representative Holberg, is this your an office amendment?
The A1 amendment?
Yes.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. And if you would move that, that would get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it.
All right. The chair will move the A1 amendment to put it in the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And trying to look around on the committee, see who was here last session. I think Representative De La Forest may be the only holdout from the session last year. We certainly spent a lot of time on issues around this particular database. And this particular bill that's in front of you today deals with what's now being called CYBRS. It's a police database that will record information, and it'll be submitted to the BCA, and then members of law enforcement will be able to log on via the computer and access records from all participating agencies. How is this different than CRIMNET? CRIMNET will link a number of different court systems, etc., where this particular database, given the nature of the information being collected, will only be available for law enforcement, and I've been told is not in the process and planning, it's not expected to become part of CRIMNET. And we had a House bill last year that we worked extensively on, and we're not able to get passed for various reasons. Following that, a working group was put together that had members from law enforcement, records clerks, responsible authorities from various law enforcement agencies, a really good working group of people. Also, the ACLU was represented, and we worked, I believe, starting in August, meeting every other week for a couple hours working on this new CYBRS database. The result of is this bill that's before you, and this particular database they're hoping will be functional by this fall. They're in the process of putting together a business plan out for RFP, and so these particular standards are important that they get passed this year in order to provide the framework for the data that's being held in CYBRS. As you know, unless we classify otherwise, all information collected by government in the state is public. And so it's important that we get the data issues relative to CYBRS resolved. The bill in front of you, subdivision, in Section 1, Subdivision 1, defines the system. It also narrowly construes a definition of law enforcement. There is some concern that we may be leaving some groups out, and it's an issue we'll continue to work on. They give the example of the university police, et cetera, so we're looking for some language in lines 16 through 18 that would define post-certified or certain levels of law enforcement, but not go as far as, say, I was before your committee last week with the Department of Commerce Insurance or Investigator Fraud Unit. We wouldn't expect that groups such as that would have access to this database. Moving into Subdivision 3, it talks about the classification of the data, and what the basic scheme is that when information is sent to CYBRS, it would be classified as confidential and not available to the subject, but they would have to have an active investigation in order to keep that classification for more than 10 days. So the majority of the information going in will be declassified and available to the data subject within that first 10-day period. If the data being collected is part of an investigation, they can hold that as confidential for up to 120 days, and at that point there'll be notification by CBIRS to the submitting agency that they're about to lose their confidential classification, and they would have to re-up, if you will, to extend that. Subdivision 4 has to do with the access to this particular database. So there were issues with the old database about who had access to it and how it was used. This will require certification by the BCA in order to have access to the information, and also that they'll have to put in a purpose code or a case number in order to access. This will then lead to an audit trail that will track all information about changes in the information, how it's being used. You'll see on page 3, lines 8 through 11, where it delineates the things that must be recorded in the audit trail for the use of this information. In addition, data subjects will have access to this information through any participating law enforcement agency or the BCA. They'll have to go to that agency, prove that they are who they say they are according to standards currently held in Chapter 13, and then be given that information, and also the names of contact persons in the various agencies that submitted the information. So if there was questions about the accuracy of the data, they would know who to contact in order to go through the process to correct the information. And Subdivision 6 allows for that process to take place. Today, to testify on behalf of the bill, we have Commissioner Campion and Chief of Bloomington, John Locks, Goodhue County Sheriff Dean Albers, and Rich Neumeister would like to say some words as well.
All right. So, is Commissioner Campion was going to testify, did you say? Okay.
Oh,
no.
He's right. Saying, waving off.
All right. We'll start then with Chief Locks, if you would come forward. Representative Ellison?
Oh, Mr. Chair, just have a question to the author.
Sure.
Representative Holberg, your bill lays out a process for holding on to information and defining information, but it does not specify what the content of CBIRS would be. What kind of information do you expect would be held in CBIRS?
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, it's an incident-based reporting system, so there will be lots of data in that information. Most agencies in these discussions will upload contact reports, requests for services, incident reports, traffic information, virtually all information that comes into their departments will be uploaded into the system.
Representative Ellison.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, if an officer is riding in the squad, for example, would they be able to access CBIRS there? And what is the typical amount of kind of information that they would have at their fingertips in that case?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, the ability to access CBIRS through a police car would, of course, be dependent on the resources available to the various departments. I'm sure that at some point that would be available in some departments, but my understanding is that most instances currently, and of course I can be corrected by the law enforcement officials here, would probably necessitate a call into some records management personnel that's back at the office to run the check.
All right. Locks, if you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Locks. I'm the Chief of Police in Bloomington. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I am here today to talk in support of House File 1810. I am on the advisory committee, the CBIRS advisory committee, along with the sheriff and others that have gone through to put this process together. I'm very well aware that in years past, law enforcement has not done the best job of auditing its own work and making sure information put in systems is put there for the right reasons and is taken out appropriately. As part of this working group, I am very confident that the checks and balances we have put in place here in this bill will correct those errors of the past. There's 530 of us around the state that need this. So this is not Sheriff Albers or Chief Locks talking here today. It's every CLIO, every chief and sheriff around the state of Minnesota that desperately needs this information. This is not an add-on. This is so we can do our job effectively. If we can't share information about criminal investigations, we are really working with one hand tied behind our back, literally. As we went through the committee, we talked about checks and balances. What would be the right things to do? We came up, first of all, how long should we keep the information confidential? We went back and forth and decided that 120 days. So this isn't in there forever. If I don't notify the system that I'm still actively investigating a case after 120 days, which is not very long, that system becomes private. It already starts moving up the chain, so the subject of the information can access it. So we want to make sure that those kinds of things don't sit in there forever. We're restricting, on the first blush, the agencies that can have access. And one of the coveralls is that, as we're talking, other agencies that have restrictions under data practices, Chapter 13, are the ones that will have access. So we all are playing by the same ground rules. In the past, we've allowed information outside our bounds and it, without proper groundwork, that can be problematic. And we're really talking about sharing information with individuals who are committing crimes here in Minnesota. I can't stress enough about how much of an important issue this is. Information is power. We've all heard that. Well, information gives us the ability to find out who else is committing crimes. We all know that the criminals do not stay in our jurisdictions. It's just imperative that we be able to talk to these people, find out who has information, conducting other investigations so we can do the best job possible. This is about keeping people safe. This is not about storing information. It's about keeping people safe. And we do that by finding out who they are, what activities they're up to, and take the appropriate action. So I'll stop my remarks there. I know the sheriff and others have things to say, but just want to emphasize how important this is to us practitioners in the field of law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Locks, you stated that the information would not be available, or I'm presuming automatically deleted, unless you informed the system that you had an active investigation continuing beyond the 120 days. Is there a way to put in an automatic notification such that when you were starting an investigation, you knew it was going to take longer than 120 days, that it would just automatically stay in?
Chief Locks?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that we would want to do that. What we try to do is figure out how this works the best, and there's never any predicting how long an investigation is going to take. We negotiated from 90 days to 180 days on how long, and thought the 120 is kind of the a number that is reasonable. It's so you can get a good feel for the investigation. The system, the way we are planning it, the work plan would be that after 110 days, we'd be notified that your information is about to turn private if you don't do something about it. And we're trying to make it very simple so there isn't a lot of forms to fill out, that the investigator could notify the system that, no, I need another 120. And the other check and balance is that if I end the investigation in 30 days, I've got 10 days to let the system know I no longer need to keep this information confidential. So there's a check and balance on both ends, so you don't automatically run the clock if you don't need to. So it kind of works both ways.
Thank you.
All right, Sheriff Albers, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
My name is Sheriff Dean Albers. I'm with Goodhue County. Mr. Chairman, just want to echo the same some of the thoughts that Chief Locks made. Law enforcement sometimes can be its own worst enemy, and keeping a lot of its data that probably is not necessary, and this is going to go somewhere to take care of that. Is this a perfect bill? No, but it's a good start, and that's what I would like to start emphasizing. We can work on this. We can start with this and work on it down the road. We need this information, as Chief Locks had talked about. Anytime you've ever been involved in a major investigation, and us being a rural area, we're not immune to people coming and going through our area. We have no idea who they are. You need that information if you have a long, extended investigation. I know from personal experience that some of them can go on for 4 years that are major events, and you need to have this. I think one of the fallacies in public is that we have this information. They watch TV. And what do they see? I type in John Doe. I know everything about John Doe. We don't have that. And we need to be able to share some of that information. But the public expects that, and they think we have it, and they expect it to a certain degree, but we also have to manage it properly, and I think this is going a long ways in doing that. And my comments here.
Thank you, Sheriff. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a question for the author, but what is the status of the system currently?
Senator Holberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, there is no system like this in operation right now. There was a system called MJNO that the Police Chiefs Association administered, and they shut down in December of 2003. And since that time, we've been working on putting together a new system that would have some standards and parameters that would address the concerns of the Data Practices Act, but still function in a way that would be useful for law enforcement. The goal is to have this new system up and running by this fall.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, does the database exist?
Senator Holberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, there is the data is currently, in most instances, that was in the old system, still held by individual law enforcement agencies as well. It's my understanding that the old data from MJNO likely exists somewhere, but maybe somebody from the Police Chiefs Association would have to address that.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, in addition to the bill that would authorize this network, I presume there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to implement this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, the beauty of this electronic age is in many instances it's going to be very easy to integrate with this system and upload not only data moving forward, but in some instances data that's held by the agency going back a number of years. One of the things that they're working on with the business plan and the profile of the actual system and computer terms, which I'm not real good with, but that will allow for various record management systems to integrate and talk with the cyber system.
Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, this appears to just be a policy bill. It doesn't appear to be asking for any money, but there has to be money involved in this, does there not?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty. At this time, there is no request for money with this bill. We are going to send it out for a fiscal note, but the BCA has determined that this is such a high priority, they've been able to find funding within their system to pay for the work thus far.
Mr. Neumeister, did you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Neumeister is going to express the concern that I failed to mention in my opening remarks, and it's related to the language on page 1, subdivision 2, the last two lines where he talks about the use of this information, and currently the law allows for the use of this information for background investigations required by state statute, and the number of background investigations required by law actually is so many that we have a full booklet of them, and we are probably going to look at doing some tuning to that language, and that this is pretty raw data, accusations, unfounded information, of course, is in it as well. And not all of these investigations are actually conducted by law enforcement. So we're going to have to work on doing a little amending to that portion of the bill as it moves along.
All right. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. The new folks that may not be here, basically MGNO was an integrated database that contained the records of almost hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans and some folks from Wisconsin, over 8 million records. And to paraphrase what a lot of folks have said is, you know, the purpose of what MGNO is was important. But the bottom line is that they had total unknowledge or disregard for the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And what some folks have been saying is that, and I'll just point out, nationally, both with the National Association of Justice Information Systems and also the Department of Justice, they've pointed out how MGNO is a bad situation to put information together. So what we're trying to do is to go from that major mistake that we did, when I say we citizens or whatever folks were involved, we're trying to do it with standards based on the Department of Justice. I'm talking about integrated criminal justice information systems, where there is accountability, where there's what we call fair information principles, which some folks under you all have heard about. But some of the concerns that I have still about this bill, which is already talked about, and one of the reasons why, depending on how it's disseminated, because if it does get into issues of reputation and privacy, timeliness and relevancy, incompleteness and inaccuracy, and rehabilitation and equality, and the kinds of data that you're going to be getting, and I encourage you, to all public, this is called the Cyber Stakeholders Group Meeting Summary. And some of the discussion that they've talked about, some of the data elements, we're talking about witnesses, complaint data, juvenile. Again, it's hopefully, and what I'm working hard on, is that it only be for law enforcement purposes. So I'm just encouraging with you, there's lots of information out there. Also, there was a risk management plan that adopted some of the national standards based on the Department of Justice to make sure it's balanced. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm still bird dogging it. There are some concerns, and we'll just see what happens. The other one is about an issue that hasn't been discussed, but I was told it's going to be done based by rule or whatever. It's the whole issue of retention, how long some of the data is going to be retained. Mr. Chairman, thanks for a few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Questions or further discussion? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Neumeister, do you think that this system contemplated in House File 1810 is an advance over the MGNO system? I mean, I know you're not perfectly happy with it, but do you feel like we're heading in the right direction?
Yes,
Mr. Neumeister.
We have standards. Individuals are able to get access to us. There's accountability to where we're local. They just can't put data and keep it on there and then hit hard on individuals down the line. This is what Representative Fulberg has been working on for about a good year. And I'm just going to share something with you. I looked at from the Information Policy Analysis Division. If you got a chance, it talks about how the situation, how folks found out about MGNO. It talked about why one legislator cares about data practices, which I'm sure everyone does. But it talks about at least where Ms. Holberg, Mr. Burden, and other interested parties, pretty much over the last year, have been going to two or three meetings. And I've been bird-dogging it, too, by getting all the material. So if I felt that we were going towards the MGNO or a secret system, or it's all going to be all intelligence-type system based on First Amendment kinds of things, which you introduced the bill, I'd be one of the first folks hollering about it right here. There needs to be some fine-tuning, there needs to be some accountability, and some publicness to it so we all feel more comfortable about it. But it's the right step. We're going in the right direction.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I just want to just say for the record that I think that everybody in the state of Minnesota owes Representative Holberg and yourself, Mr. Neumeister, and many others a debt of thanks for paying close attention to these very complicated issues. Most of us just gloss right over when this stuff is being discussed, but it has very serious implications for our democracy, so I want to thank you for it, the hard work that you did. You mentioned numerous meetings that were conducted, and so just want to say that for the record.
Thank you. Further discussion? Anything else, Representative Holbrook?
Mr. Chair, if I might, back to Representative Hilty's point about the class, I failed to mention, but I think it's an important point to make, is this system will also address another need. There's a federal database system called NIBRS, a National Institute-based or Incident-Based Reporting System, and this system will also address that. In the case of NIBRS, it is only cumulative data. It's not name-specific, but it will help law enforcement address those federal standards for NIBRS as well, which is an important side benefit to this system. And to Representative Ellison's comments, thank you, but there's a couple other people, Ms. McKnight, Mr. Verdon, and Katie Engler, and the now-retired Don Gemberling, who also have spent untold hours working on this as well.
All right, seeing no further discussion, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 1810, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Zellers, House File 1406. I will move House File 1406 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Welcome, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there is also an A-10 amendment. Mostly technical, just and then to the technical amendment, we need a slight oral technical amendment.
If you can wait 1 minute, we're trying
to
find it.
Sure, more than happy to.
Do we have that? Oh, we're passing that out right now, Representative Zeller. I've got it. I'll move that as soon as everyone has it.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, I will move the A-10 amendment to put it in the form that the author would like. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
We had just two tiny oral amendments that we needed corrections from the reviser.
Okay.
On page 3, line 8, after the word the, put in second.
Okay.
And then on lines 13, cross out everything after facilities, replace that with transfers of individuals.
So, quote, transfers of individuals, end quote?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Just those two?
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so we will incorporate into the amendment line 8 after the word the, we will insert the word second, and line 13, this is all on page 3, delete everything after facilities and replace it with, quote, transfers of individuals, end quote. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. We are here today, and I've come down with a cold that's been passing around here, so I will, for once in a lifetime, a politician's going to keep their remarks very short and brief. I have with me Eric Lippman, former representative, but always a representative in our hearts, the state sex offender policy coordinator. He's going to go over a lot of the detailed stuff. But just a couple of quick points, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. What we're here today to do is to make sure that the right professionals get the right data, and most importantly, at the right time when it comes to the Sex Offender Review Board. And in those cases where the government has permitted someone with a criminal history to work say, in a healthcare setting. We want the public to be able to learn who is caring for the loved ones, which I don't think anybody here in the committee would disagree with. In both, we are getting information to who needs it and in a very timely manner. I'll let Mr. Lippman, again, he's our state sex offender policy coordinator, go through some of the details, and then after that we'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Lippman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. As Representative Zeller suggested, because of the data practices issues and the civil commitment issues, we're glad to be here before you. There are five basic points or elements which brings House File 1406 as amended to before the committee. Referring to the second engrossment, the first appears on page 16. It provides that deliberations among members of the newly created Sex Offender Review Board, and this would operate for those sex offenders that are indeterminately sentenced, a parole board style function, much like the old Minnesota Corrections Board, that deliberations on inmate petitions for release will only occur in closed meetings outside of the hearing of the public, and yet testimony before the board or other proceedings of the board or the records of the board's decisions, that would all be maintained as public. There's certainly been some discussion about that, but would focus members on the fact, and it's also in the A10, that already data about alleged victims and also broad exemptions for healthcare data, both of which would be involved in proceedings like this, are already familiar provisions of the open meeting law and justifications for closing of those meetings to discuss that type of data. Likewise, it's also important to recognize that the open meeting law also has a broad exemption for meetings conducted by the Commissioner of Corrections, so the End of Confinement Review Committee, any hearing on a parole violation or a supervised release or probation violation, all of those meetings happen outside of the regular confines of the open meeting law. And indeed, I think this is a similar type of meeting because it has to do with inmates and offenders and their records. And so it's in line with the fairly mature and a familiar tradition in the open meeting law. Secondly, on page 41 of the second engrossment, the House file would convene a task force of state and local stakeholders to discuss possible new rules for the state courts in the civil commitment process. Members of this committee will be interested to know that of the roughly 20 states that have statutes like that here in Minnesota under the sexually dangerous person or sexually psychopathic personality, that Minnesota is alone in having a cabinet-level official be the last part of that transition process. In every other state, once a patient is civilly committed, the transition process out and increasing liberties out of treatment and back into the community, that process is all created or regulated by the court system in each of these other states. Minnesota alone has a very unique process where there's a special review board of treatment professionals assigned, appointed by the Commissioner of Human Services, and then if they react favorably to the patient's petition to have increasing liberties, whether it's a pass on campus or visits into St. Peter or some other community or even receiving treatment on an outpatient basis, all of those decisions are later subject to review by Commissioner Kudna or his successor without any aspersion at all to the very fine job that Commissioner Kudna has done and likewise his predecessors. It's the judgment of the Governor and Representative Zeller and others that there should at least be the discussions about bringing the state courts into this process. Item 3 on page 66 of the second engrossment, specially trained attorneys from the Office of Attorney General would be added to the panel that reviews the files of sex offenders for possible re-referral onto the county attorneys for a civil commitment process. As folks who have been following the newspapers in recent years know, the process at the Department of Corrections involves a review by a panel of psychologists, but there isn't a lawyer on hand to see whether a referral might well be appropriate, and in the advice rendered by the Commissioner of Corrections, there isn't a legal screen. So we'd have, again, as Representative Zeller suggests, not only the right data, but also the right data to the right professional at the right time. Item 4 appears on page 81 of the second engrossment. A select group of officials from the Department of Human Services would have access to the databases in order to perform what is called an end of confinement review. As folks on this committee may well be familiar, when a predatory offender is released from prison, an assessment is done 90 days before release, and the offender is screened and goes through a process by which they, if they're a predatory offender, they're assigned a risk level for purposes of community notification. It's called an end of confinement review committee. And either one, two, or three is assigned to the prisoner as part of their inmate as part of that process. The law also requires that when there is someone is transitioning through the Minnesota sex offender, the civil commitment process, there's also an end of confinement review committee. So quite literally, as one moves from increasing levels of security at St. Peter or Moose Lake to portions of the program that allow greater liberties, at each stage of that process, an end of confinement review committee is supposed to be convened and operated. The problem under the current law is that the DHS professionals, the treatment professionals who run the civil commitment program, aren't, quote, law enforcement officials and don't have the data to access to the data that is familiarly and routinely given to professionals in the end of confinement review committee, because they are on the prison side law enforcement officials. And so this is a needed fix for the purposes of following and fulfilling the statutory intent of having an end of confinement review committee on the civil commitment side, giving needed data and access to that data to those folks. Lastly, members of the public would have greater access to information on folks who have been granted variances and set-asides by either the Commissioner of Health or the Commissioner of Human Services when folks with a former criminal history who have been disqualified from providing what they call direct contact services receive relief from the state agencies that they are permitted to work in that setting. How that works is there are listings of crimes, and indeed it's replicated also in House File 1406. There are a series of bars, a lifetime bar, a 15, 10, and 7-year bar, which if one commits a certain crime, you are forbidden without leave from the commissioner, the relevant commissioner, whether it's Health or Human Services, from taking employment in that field as a result of that criminal condition. It's otherwise known as a collateral consequence of one's criminal conviction. However, when if a former offender who is now a healthcare worker or a worker at the daycare does indeed receive relief from the relevant commissioner and is permitted to work in that setting, there isn't any disclosure or access by members of the public who may well be customers or have loved ones who are being treated as to that grant of permission. And so this bill would authorize disclosure of those people who actually receive the waiver, receive this variance or set-aside, the grant of relief from the government, that information could be disclosed from the public. So presumably, if a former offender is now working in the daycare where my children are or the nursing home that cares for my mother, I might be able to learn about what waivers have been granted. So five important but fairly straightforward provisions, and we're eager to answer any questions that we can about the bill.
Questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to answer this can. I'm just curious as to the language about the Supreme Court task force. It's couched in the language of a request rather than a demand. Is that just for constitutional reasons? And then I guess the second part of the question would be, do you have any informal assurances that you can share with us that will happen if this is passed? Mr. Litton.
Chairman Johnson, Representative Simon, it is a request for separation of powers reasons. One, this branch cannot demand that the other branch do much of anything in particular. It's a kind request. I think they are certainly interested in having those discussions and along the format described on page 41. I think the concern that has preliminarily come back is the resources that would be involved in that, and that's something that I imagine that there will be greater discussion at the Finance Committee. We've requested a fiscal note or are eagerly awaiting a whatever pricing that this might oblige and eager to work with the court so as to reduce the fiscal impact of them coming to these meetings, because we think that the discussion is so important.
Other questions? Any further discussion? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about subject matter on page 16 to close the deliberations of the I think the board, the parole board, I think it's called. Mr. Lippman, does the board simply, how do they convey the information that the person is either denied parole, granted parole? Do they give factual findings? I mean, will there be some summary of deliberation reported if the person's turned down or granted, or is it simply just a thumbs up or down?
Mr. Lippman.
Chairman Johnson and Representative Ellison, if I could direct your attention to the A-10 amendment on page 2.
Okay.
Particularly the lines 18 through 20 in the sentence beginning on line 18, that there would be some identification, presumably to the inmate and members of the public, what petitions they were acting upon, and at the next open meeting the board shall summarize its deliberations regarding the inmate's petition. And so the narrow confines outside of the public's hearings are much as you could imagine executive privilege, which is you want people to candidly exchange their views, particularly about very violent and oftentimes extremely dangerous offenders. We want the candor, and also folks to show up for this difficult service. It will be difficult enough recruiting and retaining the kind of high-quality people that we want for this service, details that we're eager to work on now and also in the next session. But I think that the clear intention is only to shield out of that the private conferences, much as if you would have with an appellate court, the judges' conferences. But all of the other incidents of their work, both the testimony beforehand and also the results and what they've actually done, would all be available to the public.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Anything else, Representative Zellers?
Excuse me, no, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate many time. I don't know if there were some folks that might want to testify.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. Mark Anthonson? And let me ask, is there anyone else who would like to testify on any of these particular portions of the bill in the audience? All right. Mr. Anthonson, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mark Anthonson, members. I am the attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Our concern, and we have one narrow one, focuses on Section 2 of the bill. Representative Ellison just mentioned the point. I don't have to make a big song and dance in front of this committee about the particular concern in this state about sex offenders and the release of sex offenders back into the public. That's an immensely important decision, without question. We are perplexed as to why the deliberations of this board, if indeed it is established, which deliberations will discuss that very issue, should this person be released or not back into the public? How in the world can it be justified that that sort of deliberation be secret? The public has a huge stake in this issue, and it ought to have some ability to understand how these criteria are being applied, in our view. Now, Representative Lippman did talk about some precedent here. We also have some precedent that caused us to believe this summary of the deliberations as provided by the bill will not be effective. The precedent is a current exception to the open meeting law, which allows public officials to close meetings to evaluate employees, superintendents, city administrators, folks like that. That section has also said for years that the public body must provide a summary of its deliberations at the next open meeting. It doesn't work very well. You get basically, in most cases, uninformative, very brief little summaries that tell you nothing. I appreciate Representative Lippman's comment that it may be difficult to get people to serve, but I'm not persuaded by that. They will be identified. It will be known who's on this board. Their decisions will also be publicized, of course. So I don't see that there's a deterrent effect simply that is improved simply by allowing these immensely important discussions to be done in complete secret. So we would hope that would be removed.
questions for Mr. Anthonson, and then I'll let Representative Lippman come back. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anthonson, what about Mr. Lippman's point that you do have child sex assault victims? You know, what about that? I mean, for example, if they could, I mean, could you weigh that out? I mean, there are certain laws, I can't identify them right now, but that do protect the privacy of sex assault victims, particularly if we're talking about children. Now, I agree with you. I'd like to see the deliberations open, but I do see the point that there might be some occasions where they should be closed to protect the privacy of certain vulnerable victims. What do you think about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, it's a good point. As Representative Lippman testified, the open meeting law currently allows portions of meetings of any public body in the state to be closed to talk about things like victims of criminal sexual conduct. Our approach here is that that's the pattern that should continue, both in terms of deliberations and, frankly, testimony. For example, we have no problem if a victim of criminal sexual conduct is asked to testify to this board, that portion of the hearing be closed. But so there are exceptions that protect those sorts of highly sensitive issues. We just think that an across-the-board exemption from any public discussion goes too far.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ellison.
Is it your view that whenever there is usually the occasions in which, or the people who we're talking about on the defendant side are often people who have been in the news quite a bit, the public wants to know what's going on, and if they're going to be let out, the public wants to know why and what they've done, and if they're not going to be, maybe that should be known as well. Is that in the spirit of why you're taking your position?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, sure. I mean, not only are these folks often publicly well-known, as they should be, but they have been incarcerated after a highly public district court proceeding, no portion of which is typically closed. I should point out there's a flip side to this secrecy, too, that ought to be noted. It's not maybe as popular, but because there is so much concern in our society about sex offenders, there may be cases that come before a board like this where the offender really has been rehabilitated, really should be released. And if all these discussions are secret, the political pressure may cause a decision for political reasons that's not justified, and so that keeps the person committed when they shouldn't be. So there's two sides to the coin, but I think either way you flip it, it comes out that there should be more public access here.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would, and Mr. Anderson and Representative Ellison, I would just go back to the amendment. We're not going to close this off in a soundproof chamber. I mean, it's very explicitly written in the amendment. At its next open meeting, the board shall summarize its deliberations regarding the inmate's petition. When we're talking about this type of sensitive information, and your concerns are exactly why I share and why I like the way that the bill is crafted right now, we're talking about some very, very sensitive information, and I have every trust and assurance that this board will act in not only in the utmost respectful way, but also the utmost open as possible way for the public's benefit and for the public's safety. If there's some sort of change that needs to be made down the road, you and I both know we don't leave anything in place here for too long without coming back and changing and tinkering a little bit. I would be the first one to come back and make that possible change.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Mr. Atherton, and perhaps even Mr. Lippman, is there a comparable section in Minnesota law wherein we can protect vulnerable people, perhaps victims of sex assault, and close off their portion of the testimony but leave the other part open? Are there pieces of law we can just sort of import into this statute to do that? I'm not proposing an amendment. I just want to know if they exist, and if so, what they are.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, as you probably know, I work a lot with the open meeting law. The whole approach to our open meeting law for 25 years has been exactly as you described: limited, narrow, fact-specific exceptions that allow public officials to close a meeting to focus on the sensitive information But the meeting must then be reopened and the broader discussion done publicly. I appreciate the fact that some of this board deliberations will be about victims. And that's legitimate to close that. But my belief, my extrapolation, is a lot more of the discussion at this board, a lot more of the deliberation will be about the sex offender. And I don't think that's the kind of sensitive stuff that should be secret.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative. Only if you want.
Only if you would like.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members, just a few brief points of rebuttal, if I might. Mindful of what Representative Sellers said, it is clear that under 1406 as amended, the results of any determination of the parole board would be known and publicly available. With respect to Mr. Anfinson's characterization that no portion has been secret of inmates' travel through the court system, I would respectfully disagree. I think that the two other analogies can be drawn that are very similar. One, if the particular offender's case, the inmate's case, had gone to an appellate court panel, as many of them do, the deliberations of the court in arriving at their decisions is not available to Mr. Anfinson and the newspapers that he represents. It's just not. The proceedings beforehand, the arguments, the testimony, the trial, all of that is, but the decision makers, when there are multiple decision makers on the board, in this case either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, are just not available. You just can't go. I would love to go to Supreme Court conferences. I think it would be very helpful to me as a lawyer, but one is not permitted. Similarly, if the offender has been involved in any kind of probation or supervised release violation, again, the HRU process, which again is a similar type of tribunal, it is not open. If the offender has been released before and has had an end of confinement review committee, again, those portions are all secret and they're boards which operate in a similar fashion. So I think that rule, while generally true, is not in fact completely true, and the better part of the argument, I think, is that this board operates like other familiar models. Lastly, I think it's important to know, and this is revealed if members look at the second engrossment on page 16, again, there is a very broad exception for meetings of the Commissioner of Corrections. So contrary, with respect to Mr. Anfinson's characterization, that we have narrow exceptions for healthcare data or narrow exceptions for information that would identify victims of domestic assault or criminal sexual conduct, that's not in fact quite true. If you look on line 21 of page 16, a very, very broad exception at the very beginning of the open meeting law suggests that meetings of the Commissioner of Corrections, again, dealing with inmate files, dealing with questions of progress in treatment or prison discipline, all of those are exempt from the open meeting law. This is not it's only a difference in degree, not in kind. I think it's closer to the model that we already have, that we're familiar and that works well for Minnesota, and that we should continue.
Mr. Lipman, you refer to line 21, meetings of the Commissioner of Corrections. Who are generally at those meetings?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that encompasses things like the hearings and release units, which again is the probation or supervised release violators who have some sort of misconduct, and they're given due process before a penalty is exacted. Among them could be that the supervision arrangement is restructured so that there are tighter restrictions or fewer liberties, or in many cases, as is happens all the time, each and every day, the offenders return to prison for their probation violation. But those meetings happen outside of the hearing or viewing of the public.
All right.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's fine. Right there, Nelson.
I do appreciate your indulgence. If I could just refer you back, Mr. Lipman, to the I'm looking at the A10 amendment. What about if we? How would you feel about this? And again, I'm thinking about whether I should do an amendment or not. But how would you feel about this? What if the board was required to submit written findings of fact as opposed to simply a summary? That might give a little bit more public accountability? I don't know. Maybe it's a distinction without a difference. What do you think about it,
Mr. Littman? Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I don't believe it's a hostile amendment. I think the key point and the reason why we've tried to, through the A-10 amendment, cabin this idea in, it originally started out earlier in Grossman, fairly clumsily and overly broad, to describe a meeting, which I think quite rightly folks have said, well, that's a too broad of an idea. The idea that we're trying to preserve in cabin is that folks who are passing on detailed and fairly sensitive files about otherwise very dangerous people, in many cases, that particular observations on the file aren't attributed to various members of the board. I think if they can act as a as an entire board, having written findings isn't a hostile idea at all. Again, I think the Plenty administration and Representative Zellers are very pro-sunshine. We're interested in government accountability. But we're likewise interested in those narrow exceptions of being effective recruiters for dangerous and important work, which certainly this would qualify on both of those grounds. And so having them do findings or detail explicit rationale, I don't think that that's hostile at all. Having them be able to be identified with particular viewpoints, particularly after a week where in Chicago we learned that an upset and disgruntled litigant shot the family of the federal judge that passed in his case. And so, again, in that kind of atmosphere, we want to make sure that these folks not only show up for duty, but have reason to show up for duty.
Mr. Chair, I'll work with them and see what we can do.
All right. It is going to public safety next.
Yeah.
Well, any further discussion? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 8. 1406 be recommended as, I'm sorry, I will renew my motion that House File 1406 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Representative Abler. House File 1507.
Mr. Chair, we're going to jobs after this.
All right. Representative Abler, I will move that House File 1507 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. And is this the A8 amendment? Is this your... I'm sorry, wrong bill. Never mind.
There was no amendment I'm aware of, Mr. Chair. All right. Can I ask you if there is one?
I don't have one either.
Special surprise amendment to me? Or you're still thoughtful. It's the first full day of spring. Mr. Chair, this is the emergency quarantine bill. It has to do with if there were an event would happen. SARS makes it a good example. Before, we only had other less infectious diseases that were just as bad but not as wildly contagious. This is the big point of why this bill is with you. It has to do with the quarantine and then getting the court order subsequent to that. And maybe I'll just want to... I have a testifier who can talk about it. It's been kind of controversial, just so you know, the whole idea of taking a person out of an airplane and saying, you're not going home, in fact, you're not even going to the luggage, you're going to come with me and we're going to have a little, you get to spend some time, is not the kind of thing that you take lightly. However, if you just got an F in China and wound up staying with a family that was found to have SARS, probably the people who hadn't been on that plane with you or hadn't been with you on the trip would hope that you would kind of stay out of circulation for a while because it is extremely contagious. In practicality, most people are cooperative with such a request to understand that they need to stand aside until the incubation time goes away or until they're certain to be free of the disease. What this bill addresses is people who are unwilling to be so cooperative. In Toronto, there are some 30,000 people who were thought to warrant quarantine. And the bulk of them, I believe, 29,000 something, stayed in their homes happily. And I think, was it one?
It's
one person.
There one person needed a court order.
Yeah, one person needed the extra help to stay where you're supposed to with the help of the court. And I would expect that that be the case in this. And so, the way it's set up we've worked pretty hard to make it as good as it can be. And this committee is the one to scrutinize if we've done our job well enough or not. The way it's set up now is if there's an exposure that the commissioner deems to be worthy of quarantine, that the person would be put under emergency hold, and at the moment she issues a directive to, or he issues a directive to hold the person, there would be a request put to the Attorney General's office to apply for a court hearing, which would happen in 24 hours. And the court has to act right away. And so you'll look at the timetables. And the question for this committee, which I'm ignorant, is that reasonable the court can do it? We're telling them they have to do it. And I don't think that we want to put people in harm's way. They'd spend a weekend or a holiday time being held without the court reviewing it. And so this author prefers it to be quick, and so that there's the least possible chance of inappropriate quarantine. So with that, I'll turn to my testifier, and then we'll stand for questions.
All right. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Steve Shackman with Minnesota Department of Health. Also here from the department today is Dr. Terry Hull, our state epidemiologist, to handle questions relating to communicable disease. And we also have the good fortune to have Chief Judge of Ramsey County, 2nd Judicial District, Judge Greg Johnson, and Michael Moriarty, the court administrator, who had been court administrator in Ramsey and recently moved to the 10th District. The court in Ramsey has been very involved in a working group at the Department of Health, the county attorney and public health in Ramsey, the Attorney General's Office, the United States Attorney's Office, all looking at how to implement this law as it was passed in 2002 and then extended by action last year. As many of you will recall, last year the House passed the bill that Representative Abert carried. The only difference from what you passed last year to what's here this year is an additional provision that grew out of our work with the court on assuring there's a system for paying defense counsel. We ran a continuing legal education program in conjunction with Ramsey County and broadcasted by Interactive TV around the state, and had the good fortune to have some 24 attorneys express interest in defending persons who, as Representative Abert described, may need an attorney at late hour or on the weekend. And one thing the bill didn't speak to was how to pay for that. So that is a new provision that would create a schedule set up by the state Supreme Court. The other provisions that come back include some that would give direction to peace officers. We heard from sheriffs and others around the state that a commissioner's temporary hold of something they weren't familiar with, how would they carry that out, what kind of force would they use, and the language here is reasonable, necessary, but not deadly force. There's also language on job protection for people in isolation and quarantine. The Toronto experience found that in some cases people went to their jobs when they should not have and thereby spread the disease to many coworkers. This would provide that for a period of up to 21 days, you were guaranteed your job back. Finally, there's provision that doesn't relate to quarantine on mass dispensing clinics, and that's probably less in the purview of this committee, but I thought I should mention that is here as well, and would allow the commissioner where, say, antibiotics had to be dispensed to everyone in the state in a matter of a couple days, to train and appoint additional people to act outside their usual licensure to make sure that drugs or vaccinations, as the case may be, could be accomplished in the time frame you have to get it done. So let me stop with that and entertain questions for ourselves or the other people from the department and the court.
Questions? Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question to Mr. Shackman. I'm looking at page 4, line 34 of the bill. And the language we had previously said that the Commissioner of Health shall have 24 hours to apply for a written ex parte order, and now it says simply shall initiate the process. Why the change?
Mr. Shackman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Forest, Representative Abelard suggested this last year. I think it was added by the time it got to the floor. And the words initiate the process was because of the fact that the Commissioner herself would not go to court. She'd make a request to the Attorney General. The Attorney General would then go to court. It's to make the process work as quickly as possible to get the matter before the court while still assuring that someone who's not cooperative and risks spreading the disease is still subject to the hold during the time it takes for the court process to get going.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shagman, as I read the language, what we had before is we wanted to make sure that the commissioner had, within 24 hours, initiated this ex parte process, but now we're extending it beyond 24 hours. Am I correct that, and hypothetically, it could be 72, it could be 96, or any amount of time thereafter?
Mr. Representative Abel.
Well, actually, if you can find better words, I'd like it. This is meant to be quicker than 24 hours. I was uncomfortable with the delay of up to 24 hours. It's my reading of this is without delay. And if the committee wants to find language to tweak that, I'm very comfortable with language that would say instantaneously, if that would be the term. But the intention is that it's without any delay whatsoever. And so maybe we should clarify that. If you can think of words, I'm open to those. That's the intent.
Okay. All right.
So it's friendly to work on that more. Not today, if you want. Without delay, we can work on that, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the author. In reading on line 17, you sunsetted certain provisions. Page 8, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and members. Page 8, line 17, certain sections are still slated to sunset on August 1st of 2005. I find them, you're amending the session laws, and there's some language in the session laws, but also, as I read it, that is of concern to me, is contained in Chapter 12 of Minnesota statutes as well. Particularly, Representative Avar, I'm talking about oversight by the legislature in terms of being notified and also having the ability to override a gubernatorial declaration of an emergency. And I'm wondering what the intent is. Is the intent to strip out that? I'm just not sure how it works in amending the session laws when I find the same language in Chapter 12, perhaps even a question for staff.
Mr. Child, the first one, then I'll let my witness. We repealed the public health emergency. That's the short of it, and then the department can comment on the rest.
Mr. Shackman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative DeForest, you will hear on Wednesday the companion piece, I think it's House File 1555, which deals with those provisions. To make the sunsets in the two bills mesh has caused us a little difficulty. The intent is not if one bill should pass ahead of the other that you get into some anomalous situation. Right now you have an August 1 sunset, on both the quarantine provisions and the Chapter 12 emergency response provisions. And the intent is to keep some of those, to get rid of some of those, and they're all in that other bill that Representative Powell is having heard right now in local government. I think if you'd bear with us for Wednesday, you'd get a better picture of how it would work. As Representative Abler said, one of the big changes was getting rid of this concept of public health emergency, but there were other concepts like rights to refuse treatment, proper management, identification of the deceased that we didn't want to sunset. So it leads to, and it's better covered in that other bill, because the quarantine provisions are these last 18, 19, I'm not sure right now if it's Section 17, they're basically not as complicated by that. It's more that other bill that we'll have before you Wednesday.
Okay. Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, perhaps a quicker question then. Is the intent of the Department of Health to keep the legislative oversight and the notification, or is the intent to have it go away?
The intent in the other bill, Mr. Chair, Representative DeForest, the intent in the other bill is to keep it as to the larger kind of emergency called the national security emergency, and it's to take it out as to the peacetime emergency, and it would basically restore the notification to the legislature to what it was in prior to 2002. The thinking being that there are lots of peacetime emergencies, a flood in Austin, a tornado, that really don't merit bringing the legislature back. Certainly we could look at some other provision that if there were a peacetime emergency but might have a statewide impact, if you could carve something out there, we could see about adding that to the situation in which the legislature would be called back. But for numerous reasons, that public health emergency concept ran afoul of trying to have a unified incident command, a unified process for the state to respond. It created a duality that was creating more confusion than help. So we thought what we added in 2002 was added in haste, and we should go back to what was there for the previous 50 years.
Representative DeForest. Other questions? Representative Hammer.
Very quickly, one is just a point of information on page 7, line 33. Forgive me for my ignorance, but what is dispense legend drugs? What are legend drugs?
Mr. Shackman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emery, prescription drug.
Oh, okay. And then the other one, Mr. Chairman?
Representative?
The other one is for Representative Abler. I do agree with Representative De La Forest on page 4, line 34. It seems to me that you should have some kind of maximum time rather than just say initiate the process, because the problem is that can be somewhat open-ended. I think if your intent is with no delay, then you want to say, in my humble opinion, you want to say that, but in no event should it be greater than 24 hours or words to that effect, and I just ask you to consider that as you proceed with your bill. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as a friendly advice, you might want to stick some words there, then they'll have to deal with it. So you, if you can think of two or three words to insert, then the system will have to purify that as it moves along. And it has to go to jobs and then to public safety and then to the floor. So if it'd be the will of, if you could conjure up something, I'd consider that friendly today.
Representative Emmer and Representative Abler, I'm wondering if you don't just put within 24 hours back in there.
How about reverse a little bit? Shall initiate the process and then insert within 20 or without undue delay, and in no event.
Mr. Chair, except the word undue, I like it. Just like without delay, no longer than 24 hours.
Yeah.
With that, yeah. No event. I think that'd be friendly, and that moves it along.
I'd make that motion.
I'm sorry. Can you say it again, Representative Emmer?
Why don't we let Representative Abler? Why don't you say it the way you
after the word process on 934, without delay, and in no case beyond 24 hours or something like that. The wordsmith will work on this in the interim time, Mr. Chair. I assure you, they'll be talking, and we can clean it up. So thank you.
All right, so Representative Emmer, we'll vote on this just to make it official. Moves to amend on page 4, line 34, after the word process, insert the words without delay, comma, and in no case beyond 24 hours, comma. That needs a little work, but close. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Any further discussion?
One more.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more to Mr. Shackman. Mr. Chairman, perhaps just a brief tiny bit of history, since I'm the only holdover from last time. This legislation came with a great amount of controversy to this committee. I mean, obviously, we're talking about here about a concept of empowering the executive to deny civil liberties to people for a period of time, perhaps a long period of time, and that's troubling. So I'm wondering philosophically, Mr. Shackman, I hate the phrase a solution in search of a problem, but what are we trying to prevent here? What is on the horizon or so imminent a threat to Minnesota public health that we, the legislature, should be willing to empower you and others within your department to deny civil liberties to Minnesotans and to deprive them of their freedom, perhaps for weeks at a time?
Mr. Shack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Forrest, could I defer to Dr. Hull to talk about some of the infectious disease threats? In terms of the amount of time that one is deprived without a court order, as we were just discussing, that's a matter of hours.
Dr. Hull, please introduce yourself for the record and see if you can answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Forest, my name is Dr. Harry Hull, H-U-L-L, and I'm the state epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health and responsible for infectious disease control within the state of Minnesota. As far as diseases that might be applicable for isolation and quarantine, you certainly have to point to SARS as a primary example, which this still exists in China. It is a disease for which we have no treatment, no vaccine. The only preventive measure, the only way that was brought under control was with isolation and quarantine. Right now in Southeast Asia, there is an outbreak, very widespread outbreak, of avian influenza, which has limited transmission to humans, but of the people who've gotten infected, it has a mortality rate of 67%. Other diseases that this might be useful for are smallpox, bubonic plague. Both of those are likely to be used as bioterrorist weapons. But on the other hand, there are instances of bubonic plague which exists in the American West, spreading from person to person. So there are a number of diseases, and I think that the question is not just depriving individuals who are quarantined of their liberty, but also having the liberty of people to not be exposed to these deadly diseases preserved.
Twyla Brace, is Ms. Brace here? Oh. Ms. Brace, if you could come forward.
This is rubbish.
Yeah. Please give us your name and affiliation for the record and your testimony, Ms. Brace.
Sure. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I'm coming here with concerns, similar concerns that we had back in 2002 when this bill passed, and particularly because it is stripping out the sunset on most of the bill. Yeah. Okay. And what I have done to try and make this bill much more transparent for all of you, because if you look at the very back of the bill, which I know you've already looked at, you've already commented about, but on page 8, line 17, there is a sunset. But for the most part in this bill, you don't know what that sunset says. You don't know what is actually going forward and what is not, what's being sunset. So what we have put together for you is essentially the 2002 law with Representative Abler's bill superimposed on it, so that you understand what's going to be moving forward and what isn't. Our greatest concern about this bill, not only because the health department has said in other committees that they're moving these bills forward as two separate bills. So this bill is supposed to be the quarantine and isolation bill, and the other bill is supposed to be the emergency management and powers bill. But essentially the two bills have become one, and that's why I was off at the other committee trying to actually testify there at the same time of being here. The concern really is the quarantine and isolation section of the bill, which you have partially in Representative Abler's bill, starting on page 1. And in our version of the bill, it really starts on page 7. So that... Okay, so that you have a little bit more complete information in looking at our bill as to what you'd actually be passing. So let me just make it clear that in this bill there are two sections, and I have a little colored paper here so for you to understand. Section 12, emergency powers. Section 144, ongoing all the time, any day of the year, governor's fishing, skies are blue, no declared disaster authority. So there are two sections that are taking place in this bill, and you need to understand also that it's not just the quarantine and isolation provision. But we are most concerned about the quarantine and isolation. So let me begin by just saying six things. According to the CDC and off of their website, the Centers for Disease Control, during SARS, more than 90% of the people voluntarily complied with quarantine. The CDC itself says that quarantine does not have to be mandatory, and has an effect even if only 50% of the people comply, and that effectiveness maximizes at 90%. And they say that 100% compliance is not required. They also say, and I'll quote this for you, historically, placement in quarantine has been associated with increased disease transmission. They also say that obtaining and maintaining public trust are key to successful implementation of these measures. So keeping that in mind, you want to keep the public's trust in order to decrease the transmission of disease. But unfortunately, I think that Representative Abler's bill is not going to do that. And so let's just go through, and I will tell you the page and the line. So page 2,
Ms.
line 17.
How long do you think your testimony will be?
Oh, maybe about another 5 minutes.
Okay. If we could keep it to that or shorter, that would be great. We do have another bill today.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just have a question on a comment that was made. Do you want me to hold it until after the entire testimony?
Why don't we wait? Okay. Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, page 2, line 17. The important thing to notice here is that there is no words about an emergency or a disaster. This ongoing anytime power to detain citizens is at the sole discretion of the Commissioner of Health. Page 3, line 24 to 30, talks about adding language about using all necessary and lawful means to apprehend, hold, transport, quarantine, or isolate a person, except deadly force. So I looked up into the law to find out what deadly force is, because after all, you're wanting to have the public trust. And deadly force, according to Minnesota Statutes 609-066, says that deadly force does not include less lethal munitions. In other words, it says that the police can include projectiles which are designed to stun, temporarily incapacitate, or cause temporary discomfort to a person. So here's a time where the Commissioner of Health, the executive branch, can actually go out and have someone stunned or incapacitated without the governor knowing about it, without anyone knowing about it, and without a court order. If you go to page 4, line 10, that's the temporary hold. That's where it says that they can actually do this without a court order, and now the language seems to have changed to at least have the court order in 24 hours, to apply in 24 hours, but not to get it for another 24. So there's 48 hours in which time individuals can be detained without anyone else being notified, not even the governor. Then when you go to page 4, line 20, I find this interesting that it says under the commissioner's best medical judgment. And my question is, when does the commissioner have medical judgment? This language determines the length of the quarantine, the amount of time the individual have to be in quarantine, and according to the commissioner's medical judgment. And most likely, and I don't believe we've had a commissioner for a long time who is a physician, which is the only ones who have medical judgment. Page 4, line 34, you already talked about the initiating the process, and I'm glad to see that that language is being changed. Page 5, lines 5 to 11, the same language of concern being lawful means to apprehend people. But then we get to the lawful representative, page 5, line 32. It deletes the word other lawful representative. So a citizen now doesn't have a choice for who's going to represent them. It may make it more expensive, especially if the counsel provided by the health department refuses to do the appeal. And if you look down on page 6, line 11, it says that a counsel, which is provided by the health department, does not have to pursue an appeal. So here you have counsel that's supposed to help, but they are paid for by the health department, and they don't have to pursue an appeal if they don't think there's enough evidence. So now the other person has to go out and get counsel, but they can't even get some other lawful representative. And then page 6, lines 32 to 36. This is of great concern to us. It's sort of in here on its own, and it says that there are four possible situations whereby this decision regarding employment and quarantine can be made. This language really... why is it here? If you look at the rest of quarantine and isolation language, it all comes from a directive from the health department. But here it says that the term applies to persons who comply with isolation or quarantine restrictions because of a commissioner's directive, an order of a federal quarantine officer, a state or federal court order, or a written recommendation of the commissioner or designee. Well, who are all these people, and how did they just arrive into this part of the bill? And I'll tell you that in 2002, when Representative Lippman heard the word designee, we talked about who is this designee. Could it be someone from the United Nations, someone from the World Health Organization, someone from the federal government, who would make decisions about what happened to people in Minnesota? He took that out. The second we were done testifying, he said, we need to get rid of that. We can't have some designee from somewhere making decisions about what happens to people in Minnesota. So those are our concerns, as well as in the sunset language, and you'll have to look at our version of the bill in order to find it, but it is sections 10 and 11 which are being sunset. Sections 10 and 11 have to do with the legislative authority over what's happening. So, Mr. Chair and members, our concern is that this bill this bill didn't make it through the House Heifer Conference Committee. It was actually defeated, and part of the reason it was defeated was the concern about the isolation and quarantine and the ongoing authority. And the only way it actually became law was because it had a sunset on it. And now the sunset's being taken away and being made permanent policy for the state of Minnesota. It's not about an emergency. It's about any time, all the time authority without oversight. And we feel that this part, especially the part that says no court order, should go away.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Brace.
You.
Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brace, thank you for coming forward. A number of your concerns are extremely valid and fair. A couple of the comments, though, that you made, I just wanted to get some clarification on. You indicated in your testimony that 90% of the people are already complying with quarantines. But how do you deal with, if that's the case, and if because we have 90% compliance, how do you deal with those who are purposely trying to spread something, such as the bioterrorism type scenario?
Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad. Broad? Is it Broad?
Broad.
Broad, sorry. If you're talking about bioterrorism and purposely trying, it seems to me that I'm not sure if there's actual law for that, but that's not quarantine and isolation, purposely trying. I guess if they're going to be their own body and use their own body, if that's perhaps what you mean. But the health department already has authority in 144 to take someone in, but a court order is required. And there are plenty of situations today where we actually get court orders, and it's a very quick process. But this would say that no court order has to be had. It is, I'll find it here, Minnesota Statute 144.4182, Temporary Emergency Hold, and it requires a court order.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And this actually, the way it's written, if I understand it correctly, it would actually speed up that process in terms of getting people taken out of the system to spread the disease. But aside from that, one of the other things that you mentioned was the Centers for Disease Control suggested that 100% compliance is not necessary and that quarantine actually increases the transmission. Can you maybe provide me with some more information on where that would come from? And I think there obviously isn't time to talk about that, but if you could get that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Brace, if you could provide that to us, we could give it to all members.
Mr. Chair, I will do that, but I will say just in brief that it's very clear that when you put people together into a, just imagine somebody at the Mall of America, let's just say, and keeping in mind that this is not about emergency situations. This is about all the time. But let's just say we have some people in a house. If you keep them in the house and one person has something and the other people haven't yet gotten it, you keep them all exposed to the same air and you don't let anybody out. So that's why historically quarantine has caused increased, and that's a quote right out of the CDC and what's on their website.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on that, I certainly would like to hear what our own state epidemiologist or somebody else has to say about that statement that Ms. Bray has made. And I also would like to know what's going on in the rest of the states. This certainly isn't unique to Minnesota, and maybe our state epidemiologist could let us know what some of these counterparts do.
Dr. Hall, if you could, as briefly as possible, answer that. We do have another bill on the agenda as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think it would be fair to say that Ms. Brace is taking the information out of context. Certainly there are diseases where if I were sitting here carrying that disease, I would be exposing the people within 6 feet of me to a deadly infection, something that would kill them with a 30% probability. And I think that what is missing from the conversation here is what are my rights as an individual to be protected from a single individual who is carrying a deadly disease.
Further discussion. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, it strikes me that this bill merits further study. It was controversial last time. It's controversial still this time. I think that Representative De La Forest put his finger right on the button when he said that, you know, this is heavyweight stuff and we need to really, really look at it. So I'm not comfortable at all with the sunset provisions, and I won't be voting for them. But, Mr. Chair, because we might be able to get somewhere if we look at this thing a little more carefully, I'm going to ask that we lay this thing on the table and make that motion at this time.
Mr. Representative Abler, your thoughts?
I'd like to point out that this virtually this entire bill in both parts passed the House floor overwhelmingly last year, and you would have voted for it most likely unless you were there. Just I don't know your voting record, but the majority of the House, 120 something or a very high number of people voted for this. If you're concerned about the specifics of the concerns, we can discuss those. And I just have the language on page 6 about the appeal is the very same language taken from the civil commitment law under 253D. It's a model after that, and if you're not in a medical capacity to defend yourself, that the attorney has no duty to go on to appeal if there's no point, which is a valid. The designee issue is an unlawful representative came from the Supreme Court. They were concerned that you'd having people practice law who weren't able to practice law. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is ready to progress, and it would be in the interest of at least if you could take a vote on that and then not just lay it over, but I would prefer it to move on and get done this time. It's a very important piece of legislation. May we never need this in our time. The commissioner has yet to offer an emergency hold to anybody in the memory of, as I've asked about this, so I'll stand for more questions.
Representative Ellison, I'm sorry, did you make a motion or did you not make a motion?
I move that we lay it over.
Okay. I believe that's not debatable, but I'm not certain of that. Is that correct, Ms. McKnight? You know. It is not debatable. All right. Then the motion before us is to lay House File 1507 on the table. Not debatable. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The bill is still before us. Further discussion? Any further discussion? All right, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1507, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development. Mm-hmm. All those in favor, please say aye.
Mm-hmm. Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Abel. All right, the last bill on the agenda, Representative Finstead's House File 952. We likely will not finish this bill in 5 minutes. I would like to go until 2:30, and if we do not, if we're not able to finish it by 2:30, then we will reconvene at 4:30. Representative
Powell. I thought I saw Representative Powell in the room too. Are we not taking up? This is the last bill on the agenda.
This is the last bill on the agenda.
Okay, so that's good.
We didn't have a bill, did we? Representative Finstead, I will move House File 15. I'm sorry, wrong one. I will move House File 952 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health, Policy, and Finance. And is this an author's amendment, A8?
excuse me, yes, Mr. Chair. It was in the original bill, and then it was a drafting error and a delete all in the Health and Human Service bill. So that brings it into a form I'd like to talk about.
I will move the H0952 A8 amendment to place it in the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 952 is the Positive Alternative Act. And essentially, in a nutshell, what this is, it allows the Department of Health to make competitive grants available for those organizations in Minnesota that are encouraging and providing women with the opportunity to carry their pregnancies to full term. The reason we're in this committee today in front of you is dealing with Subdivision 4, the Severability Clause. And essentially my testimony on that portion would be this, that this bill is targeted to help the most vulnerable citizens of the state of Minnesota, and that's the unborn. And it's my feeling as the author of this bill that if the courts were to strike down any provision in this bill, that I would like the good work and the good intent of this bill to carry on and indeed providing help to the most vulnerable citizens of the state. So that's my pitch. I have Andrew Arau with MCCL here with me if there is questions or concerns, and I appreciate the committee's hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Finstead. So just to make sure I have this right, you are going to Health to discuss most of this bill. In particular, our interest is on page 4, lines 2 through 10, in the severability provision. Discussions or questions on the bill? We do have, I'm sorry, Ms. Rowe, you're not testifying, okay? I see no questions at this point, but I do have another testifier, Mr. Stanley from NARAL. If you could come forward, introduce yourself, and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Stanley, and I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. And NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota here is testifying on behalf of the majority of Minnesotans who are pro-choice. We are in opposition to House File 952 because we think it's wrong for the state to lend its imprimatur to organizations that mislead, misinform, and coerce women. In support of that statement, I have three pieces of information. Unfortunately, these testifiers could not be with us today, so if I could ask the clerk to pass out. I have before me a paper that was written by Julie Semenitis. It was a star paper for her master's degree in social responsibility from St. Cloud State University. And the title of the paper is called Crisis Pregnancy Centers in St. Cloud, Minnesota, Are Women Being Misled? I believe I have enough copies for the full committee. Second piece of information I'd like to distribute to the committee is testimony for another testifier who could not be with us today. Her name is Ann Halverson. She has testified before, not before this committee, though, in the Senate side. Ann Halverson is a 21-year-old who, when she thought she was pregnant, she went to the Birthright in downtown Minneapolis, where she had an unsatisfactory experience at that Birthright. She then went to the Midwest Health Center for Women, where she was given all options counseling. The result of that all options counseling was that she took the pregnancy to term, and she now has a one-year-old child. If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just read three paragraphs from her written testimony, and then I'll offer these for the clerk to pass out as well. So Ann Halverson says, I can only share with you what my personal experience was. That was helpful to me was a clinic that was honest and presented all my options without bias. I did not experience this at Birthright. My experience at Birthright made me feel as though having this child was the only right thing to do. I left there feeling as though I had really screwed up. They didn't share with me any resources like clinics for prenatal care or places I could turn to for housing or food. I felt scared and alone after leaving Birthright. I don't believe that giving government money to these clinics is appropriate. The staff are not medical personnel, nor do they give out medically accurate information. They are not as supportive as they purport to be. They do not present the full range of medically safe and legally available options to women. They decide what's best for pregnant women before she has a chance to consider the options and her reality. How will she support a child? Is she physically able to carry a child? Would she be able to give up her child? Last paragraph. I do believe that if the government wants to invest in ways to prevent unplanned pregnancies, not just abortions, they should be investing in organizations that present medically accurate information to people about birth control and alternative options to pregnancy. This includes comprehensive sex education in our schools and also supporting family planning programs and clinics staffed by medical personnel. So I have Ms. Halverson's testimony here for the clerk as well. And I'll give these to him as well to pass out so he's not scrambling around. This, what I have before us here, are copies of, I guess we would call them, let me just get the right name of the document, consumer complaints to the Attorney General's office. I have 8 such complaints, and then the names have been redacted for privacy purposes, and then behind the complaints are the responses from the Attorney General's office to these complaints. I've highlighted them for your convenience, and I just would like to read 2 of them, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stanley, maybe if you could point us to them, we could probably read through them. Do keep in mind, we're discussing, in particular, the severability provision on page 4.
Fair enough.
You could try to direct your comments to that.
Fair enough. If I may, I would just like to then tell you that the very first of the customer the consumer complaints that's in this packet is the one that I would call your great attention to, and then the second to the last one as well, but there are eight altogether for your review, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Stanley? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Mr. Stanley or Representative Finstad, can you tell me about the state of the law as it relates to if you're going to provide women's health services and reproductive health services, can you discriminate between an abortion providing agency and one that doesn't? Because I tell you, there's a lot of good stuff in this bill, and when you get up to paragraph E and F, it looks like we may get into some constitutional problems. What is the state of the law as it relates to saying we're going to give grants for women's reproductive health, but not to these groups who do reproductive health, and but only to these groups who do it the way who provide it another way? You understand what I'm saying? Can we do that legally? Is that legal?
Representative Pinsett.
Mr. Chair, you know the answer probably better than I do. If I look around this table, I would hate to see the billable hours I would have to pay to be in front of this committee. But I guess it would come down to this. I mean, the state of Minnesota offers millions of dollars in grants for millions of different programs. And in those grant proposals and programs, there is outlined eligibility requirements. So I guess, you know, I would just say this is another piece of the eligibility to apply and qualify for these grants that the Department of Health would be providing, no different than any other grant program that the state offers and with their eligibility list.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ellison.
Well, you may not like it, and maybe I don't, and maybe a lot of people don't like it, but the Supreme Court said that the right to an abortion is a fundamental right. And there may be eligibility requirements, but can the state offer a grant-giving program that essentially denies organizations that provide for the exercise of that constitutional right? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I understand what you're saying, which is, hey, a lot of grants have different criteria. This one just has different criteria, too. But my question is, I bet you in those grants that you're talking about, they don't restrict access based on whether or not an agency helps a person, a recipient, carry out a constitutional right. And I'll be honest with you, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I'm not being cute or facetious this time. I mean, I really don't know. And if anybody does know, I'd be curious to know what their take on it is. Because the last thing I want us to do is pass legislation that is not going to make it, you know, past the Supreme Court. And I don't think you want to do that either. But, you know, because the truth is, we do need more services for women, women's health. And to the degree that your bill does that, then fine. But paragraph E and F would seem to restrict access to certain providers who provide abortion services may get us into a lot of trouble constitutionally. If you don't have any thoughts on it, that's fine, but maybe the other gentleman does, or maybe somebody in the audience does.
Representative Ellison, I don't know the answer to that either. I do know that the Supreme Court has told us that certain reasonable restrictions, depending upon your definition of that, are constitutional. The question is, would these be those? Has anyone researched that particular issue? Representative Finstad?
Mr. Chair, I would say this. In the context of the grants, I suppose, you know, you could consider this a restriction if that's what you're saying, but I don't consider this a restriction for the simple fact that if you provide these services or want to provide these services, no one's making you apply for the grants. And you still have the constitutional right then, if you're a woman, to choose this place or that place and choose an abortion or not choose an abortion. But what we're saying, that in this grant that we're creating, that's part of the criteria.
Mr. Stanley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ellison, to my knowledge, we have had some attorneys who have reviewed this bill and have talked to us about a variety of concerns regarding constitutionality, but, you know, I don't have the specifics in front of me, but they have disclosed that some elements, including the one that you've targeted, you know, may have constitutional questions.
Any further discussion? Representative Slaway.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I have to say I'm not a lawyer, so can you explain the separability clause is worded where the normal layperson has a difficult time understanding it. Can you tell me in layperson's terms what does that do?
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now we're speaking in terms I understand. I'm just a dumb farm kid from Sleepy Eyes. So, like I said in my opening, how I see it is this, that this, the severability clause in this bill says that if a portion of this, if the courts rule that, you know, if they strike down a portion of this bill, the rest of the bill will continue forward as law if passed and signed by the governor. So what we're saying is that if a portion of this, I mean, I just sum it up again, I guess, for the third time, I keep repeating myself, but the way I've understood it, and we have a lot of lawyers, and I could probably explain to you a little bit better, but the way I've understood it, that if a portion of this is stricken down by the courts, that the rest of the bill will continue to be enacted.
And Representative Slawick, this is relatively common in contracts, mm-hmm. and we do see it sometimes in statute as well, that says that sometimes you will see with a contract, a court will say, well, because this provision A is not legal, we're going to say the whole contract is void. Mm-hmm. And the same could be said for a statute, so I think that's what he's trying to avoid happening.
But, Mr. Chair, maybe I'm missing something here, but so you're saying that they're going to get the grants, and then if it's unconstitutional, they don't have to give the money back? Is that sort of where we're headed? And the process still stays in place? And what, how does that work?
Representative Pinsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse, I think, a little bit. And again, we're getting on shaky grounds for me, but if there was an attorney on the committee that could answer it. But I don't know for sure how to address that.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, you know, it seems to me that whoever drafted the bill is concerned about the constitutionality of the bill, which is why the severability provision is in the bill. And so it wouldn't be there unless somebody is a little concerned that that might happen. And so I think that if they strike the language in paragraph E and F, which says that abortion-providing agencies are ineligible for these grants, if that's stricken, I guess the rest of the bill would remain such as there would be these eligibility grants for the Commissioner of Health to award eligible applicants. And then, of course, in subdivision 2, it lays out who's eligible. And that's how I understand the severability clause.
Representative Ellison and Representative Slawick, I would probably read it the same way, in that if a court struck down E and F, the organizations that received the money would probably have to give the money back, and then you'd move forward, I mean, if the money was still there. But, you know, there may have been a concern about a different part of the bill, too. This isn't uncommon language, I don't think. So I've certainly seen it in other bills and statutes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
And to the author, I think, you know, rather than dance around the issue, we'll just come out and say it. I mean, I think what this is trying to do is prevent groups like Planned Parenthood from getting grants. So would they be eligible for grants if that part was struck down, right? All groups that provide any kind of pregnancy counseling then would be eligible.
That's how I would read it, if court struck that part down.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Slavik. Just one last question. I mean, this is not severability part, but I do need to know, the $2.5 million, where are we going to get that?
Representative Pinstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A unique question for the Civil Law Committee, but I will. It's going back to Health and Human Service Finance if it passes through this committee. And in that, as we put together our omnibus bill, we will be looking at the different priorities. It is currently in the governor's budget proposal in the Department of Health's spreadsheet. So, I mean, it comes down to, on the Health and Human Service Committee, I guess it would be making our list of priorities and figuring out how we're going to fund them within the parameters of the targets.
Representative Westrom.
My amendment, Mr. Chair.
If you'd like to offer it.
Mr. Chair, I would like to offer the amendment. However, I didn't get it in before today, and so I guess it depends upon what the committee's the committee wouldn't object to the amendment, I'd like to offer it. But
Representative Western, the
it's
way
up to your discretion, Mr. Chair.
The way we have handled at least most of these in the past is that I have allowed them unless anyone objects to allowing it. And so I'm going to ask that now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Slaughter. Is this H095288?
A9. We already did A8, which was timely.
I don't know if we have this, Mr. Chair. Oh,
sorry.
Here it is.
Yeah, they just, I think it was just passed.
Okay.
Representative Broad.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate and understand Representative Westrom's concerns and will to, in his mind, make the bill better. I do think, though, Mr. Chair, that you have held pretty consistently on the rules of this committee, and I also understand that this bill does have further committee stops, that it would have an opportunity for Representative Westrom to discuss the issue with the bill's author at that point, and With that, Mr. Chair, I guess I would object to that.
All right. Representative Westrom, my understanding of the rules is as long as there's an objection, I will set it aside unless you call for a vote of the committee to overrule me on the issue of hearing a late amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hate to overrule the chair of the committee. I would like to vote on this. I'm not inclined to support the bill without making it better, Mr. Chair, and that's the reason I brought the amendment. And I didn't catch it was on the agenda till this morning, and but I understand it was on the agenda before Friday last week. So that's my concern. But Mr. Chair, maybe I'll.
And Representative Westrom, I know this is going to health policy and finance. So would that ease your concerns a bit?
Well, yeah, I do, and I was just going to say that actually this amendment fits better in that committee as well. I mean, we are discussing severability here, and the chair really distinctly stated that that was the portion of the bill that we were to be discussing here in civil law, and so I do think that the amendment is better placed in that committee.
Which committee, Mr. Chair? Representative Smith's?
Policy and Finance is where it goes next.
But it just came out of that committee.
No, that's where it's going.
Representative Finstead, wasn't this just in HHS last week?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, yes it was, but it didn't have a fiscal note. It went through the policy for the policy, and now it's going back for the finance discussion.
And Representative Finstead, would they be willing to look at another policy issue?
Well, this actually is probably a little bit of both, Mr. Chair. So I would, and I've talked to Representative Westrom earlier today, but I would be more than happy to talk to him in the next few days and see where we can go on.
Mr. Chair, I'm not on that committee, so I can't offer it. So that's the problem. But I mean, the bill can proceed as if is, and it gets out of committee, it gets out of committee, and that's what I have to do.
All right, so you are not calling for a vote to overrule on the issue of the amendment?
No, not right now, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Broad. I'm sorry, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The questions that I have are, like most of my questions, education for myself in nature, and I'm going to pass that on to move the bill along a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to request a roll call, but I also just wanted to maybe get a clarification on the discussion that you and Representative Slawick were having regarding the payback of the funds. I'm trying to understand that from a non-lawyer perspective, too, in that if E or F were found unconstitutional, I guess I'm not understanding why Subdivision 4 would then require any payback of those funds. It would seem to me that that it would go out from there forward, but maybe, Mr. Chair, you can educate me a little bit.
Well, Representative Broad, I was guessing it was, as I think, you know, we often do as lawyers, as what a court might do. My thought would be that if a court were to find that it were somehow unconstitutional to say that only certain groups based upon their abortion philosophy could get these funds, that they may require that funds already paid be paid back, but they may not. I really don't know. I probably shouldn't guess anymore. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the issue that was in my amendment, which I think is a policy issue, I guess I think it applies to every provision of this bill. And what my amendment was trying to do was, I think, take a bill that's got good merit and one, stretch the money, but also make it a policy that stretches the money further. My amendment would have required, and Representative Finn said, I would sure like these discussions to continue on, assuming this bill would even get out of this committee today, to have some private match of in-kind or and cash to these grants. I think there's always a problem as we expand groups, and Planned Parenthood I would put under the same category. When you just let them take up to 100% of their operating budget with grants from the state, you diminish their effectiveness in establishing grassroots support. And so that's the concern I have. This bill has no limits on it. It could fund a center 100%, and in a budget situation like we are now, I think we ought to be taking this money from the grants that are already out there that go to Planned Parenthood and other abortion clinics, and make this part of the alternatives that we fund under those grant proposals. And I think we really need to seriously look at taking and having these as matching grants, so we don't, 10 years from now, find these centers more focused on state budget issues than their mission of helping out females who are unexpectedly pregnant and really looking for answers and options for themselves. And I think that's a danger we run the risk of by giving them 100% grant authority under this bill.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 952, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. A roll call has been requested.
Representative Broad?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Ellison?
No.
Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Guilty?
No.
Representative Lesh?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Slavik?
No.
Representative Westrom?
Same.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative De La Forest?
Yes.
The motion prevails on a vote of 6-5. Members, we do not have to come back later this afternoon. We are adjourned.